All right, let's do this. Can you, no, we're all good. I was going to ask you to move up, but it's okay. It's all good. All right, so, I'm supposed to say, by the way, I think this is this working now?
Yep,
it's on, so, you're being recorded right now, audio, not visually, in the audio mode. So if you don't want to be recorded, maybe don't say something right away, or maybe phrase it in code or something, or we can just cover it up or something. So you're being recorded right now, apparently. So I'm Matt. Nice to see you. Thanks for coming up. On the Passover Easter weekend or whatever other religious affiliations you might have on this long weekend. Do you guys get a long weekend? Do Americans get long? No? Really? Yeah. I'm from Canada. We get like 4 days off or something like that. I've never really understood exactly why, but it's something on Friday and something on Monday happened. So, yeah, my partner who was brought up Catholic always constantly kind of helps me figure out those things. We got 1:45. We got until 1:45 apparently. Or, no, what do we got till? To 1:45? No, 2:45 or 2:30. What do we got?
2:30.
Thank you. Good Lord. We're gonna have to end that then because apparently you guys are gonna have to rush off to go get your chocolate flavored condoms and your condom flavored chocolates. My idea then is to speak for maybe about half an hour, maybe 40 minutes or something like that. Then we can chat and see what happens after that. And I got nothing to do after that, so if you wanna. We're going to talk after that. I got nothing but time for the rest of today. So my name's Matt. I'm from Vancouver. And I just by good fortune, happened to be in New York for the Anarchist Book Fair. So I had the good luck to be able to pull by. And I've never been to the Anarchist Book Fair here before. I've only been the ones in Montreal, and it looks terrific. Looks like it's coming along all right. So I'm gonna forward a short argument to you and see what you think about it. And I should emphasize that it's an argument that's in construction as I go here. So I not only seriously appreciate your questions, your kind questions, and your thoughtful critiques, but I welcome them because I'm trying to. Frank, well, you'll get it as I go along here, but I'm trying to figure this argument out as I go. And I'm going to try to get to it by telling you a little story about this exchange program I run between East Vancouver, where I live. And a little town in the Northwest Territories called Fort Good Hope, which photograph here. I'm going to tell you a bit about it, and then I'm going to try to see if I can work an argument out of it. But I'm not particularly going to be talking about indigenous cultures per se, because I don't really know enough to talk about them. And even more than that, really, I'm not really even talking about the Satu Dene, who I've spent much time with, but frankly don't feel knowledgeable enough really to talk in public a whole lot about them either. What I am going to be making an argument about. I'm going to make an argument about tolerance, I'm going to be making an argument about multiculturalism, and I'm going to make an argument about intercultural intersection. We'll see what you think of it. And I guess maybe the kind of the larger frame on the argument is a question in my mind about how it's possible to stand for, with, and beside Native folks in a way that isn't culturally corrosive and doesn't replicate much of the colonialism that I personally have been handed and tend to reproduce without thinking. So even those of you that don't have a lot of experience with Native folks, with any luck, we can draw some stuff out about intercultural encounters. The story would start with, maybe about 2000. For many years, for about 20 years now, I guess, I've been running small community schools and educational projects on the east side of Vancouver, which is a poor, in parts gentrifying, end of Vancouver. And in 2000, I opened a youth center, something like a youth center called the Purple Thistle Center with seven teenage friends of mine that is organized on a horizontal democratic process, has a collective of kids that run it. It's all volunteer and is home to about 200 kids on a fairly regular basis. We run a whole series of classes and workshops and programs and stuff that are all free and we're pretty much open 24/7. Out of that project, for many years I did took kids traveling. Just me and my partner would just buddy with fill up vans with kids and just go take an off for a month or so camping somewhere through the Southwest or whatever. We would always try to do trips every year. And then about in 2002, a buddy of mine who I'd worked with for many years in East Van. A guy called Mark, who grew up in this little Italian town called Fort Good Hope. His mother died, and he was cleaning out his closet, you know, her house and stuff. And in her garage, he came across all the stuff that she collected over the years, all these kind of photographs, these documents, the ephemera, kind of cultural artifacts, stuff that his mother had collected because the family spent much of the time in the north of Canada. And among them were a whole bunch of photographs that were actually unique. And so he called up many of his buddies who were still up there, including the then current chief and mayor, a guy called Frank, and said, "Hey, you know, would you be interested?" And of course, they were incredibly interested in receiving it all. So he did a project where he took it all back up to the community and returned it all. And many of the people in the community had never seen a photograph of themselves and much else. And so it was kind of an interesting project for Mark. And on return, he took some photos when he was up there himself. Hey, what's up, eh? So he took a bunch. So he brought back a bunch of photographs, and we were looking at it together. Pictures of this town. The town is, if you were to kind of look at North America and try to put a dot in the middle of nowhere, it's kind of that. It's, if any of you are much up on Canadian geography, it's about 750 kilometers northwest of Yellowknife. Yellowknife is at about 60 degrees latitude. It's where the Arctic Circle and the Mackenzie River cross. It's a town of about 500 people, primarily Satu Dene, with some Métis and a couple of... hey, Brooke, how you doing, bud? Good. Hey, how you doing? And a couple of... a sprinkling of whites thrown in. Mostly teachers and service sector people who take off real quickly. And among the pictures, among the things that that I noticed in Good Hope was this picture here. In a town of 550 people with about 180 people under the age of 18, there are two rival gangs, two rival and active gangs, East Side and West Side. And if you can believe it, actually it creates a dynamic in a small town where actually there are parts of town that it's kind of dangerous to go, which sounds absurd in a tiny little place that you could, you know, throw a rock across almost. And there are certain kind of like streets, and I use that word loosely, streets where at nighttime you want to just kind of keep your head up. And among the other things I noticed that, well, I noticed but wasn't particularly observant, was that the West Side crew uses a swastika as their tag. So when you arrive at the airport, which is a fun thing to do, because it's just a Quonset hut with a piece of plywood saying "Welcome to Good Hope" on it, but someone has tagged it with a huge swastika. So when you come rolling into town in these little tiny airplanes, you roll down this thing, you look out and there's a swastika greeting, you think, "What the fuck is that?" You know? Like, what is that? And after some time, the leader of that crew is a Noel, and I think his tag has done what it was intended to do, which is piss people off in a kind of low-level way. So after noticing this and thinking about it for some time, Mark and I called up Mark's buddy Frank, and we said, you know, hey, would you know, we got this idea, maybe would you be interested in doing a youth exchange? And so he was, and so it took some time. We accessed some money that in Canada is meant to bring French and English people together, west to east. But we accessed some money and went north to south and set up this exchange. So we did the first one in 2003, and it was terrific. It was fantastic in all the kind of, you know, ways that you would normally say that some kind of cross-cultural exchange project would be fun and all the funky stuff, right? Because in a town of 550 people, the nearest road is 350 kilometers away, and so there's not a ton of access out of there. Just even so, to fly there, you got to fly from, or to fly from Vancouver up there, you fly from Vancouver to Edmonton, Edmonton to Yellowknife, Yellowknife to a smaller town of 600 people, and then from called Norman Wells, or from Norman Wells on up. So it's difficult to get out, and just the cost of one person is about $2,200 before tax for that plane fare. So it's difficult to get out, and for all kinds of reasons. And you know, most folks up there don't have a lot of friends or acquaintances down south, so it's expensive and all that stuff. So it was exciting, and the exchange was exciting to do for all the kinds of, you know, obviously kind of cliched reasons that you can imagine. But it's fun also too for people from a small town, because they're not actually on the Arctic Circle. So for example, bringing kids down to Vancouver, never seen a horse, never seen a big tree, never seen the ocean, never seen anything like a movie theater or any of that kind of stuff. So that's all fun to do with kids like that. Despite the fact that they're inundated with 21st century technology, all of them have internet, super internet capable computers. They all are buried all over Facebook and MySpace and Bebo and all kinds of other stuff. They're and they're, you know, constantly watching movies and video games and have all the kind of, you know, articulateness about urban Southern North American behavior that are idiomatic. But it's also equally fun for us to go up to the north, because for many of the kids that I take up there, they've never left British Columbia, they've never been on a plane, certainly never driven a snowmobile way too fast, certainly never shot a moose, certainly never ate something they shot, certainly never tore something apart with their bare hands and then ate it. So all those are equally fun and equally surprising for us. But the exchange was interesting and kind of compelling enough that we've kept doing them since on a quasi-annual basis, because the funding's hard to come by. And in recent years, I started trying to think about it a little bit more systematically. I tried to think about it in terms of doing a little bit of research, thinking about it in terms of trying to systematically try to analyze what was going on, and just to try to talk about it a little bit, about our experiences and our encounters. Just for fun, I got a couple more pictures I can show you here, just to give you an idea what's up here. That's the town there. It's the thing on the top of the hill is the Barron Council office, which actually has fallen. That's the Mackenzie River to your right. That's from the highest point in town. That's playing hockey, which we do a ton of up there. That's one of my favorite pictures, because every feast you get, just tons of Jell-O. That's my buddy Mark out in the river there. That's us on that little plane going up. Little plane of like 8 people. That's us out hunting. It's one of the guys taking us out hunting. It's one, I'll just stop it there. That there is a game that you play, we play a lot of when we're up there. It's a traditional, it's common all across the North. It's essentially just a hand game. It's embarrassing else. It's just gambling. It's like you put something in your hand, you say which one the hand's in. You know, you got to guess, and if you're wrong, you lose. If you're right, you win. But you kind of put like a coat over us, and you try to, you know, make people kind of confused. And then everybody surrounds you, and they sing and drum at like, I don't know, like 120 decibels, which confuses the hell out of you and kind of panics me actually quite a bit, because you doubt yourself right away. And so it's a traditional gambling game from the North. We play all the time, which is kind of quasi them taking our money, which is great fun. But as I started thinking about this, and as I tried to think about it a tiny bit more systematically, I just kept on running into all kinds of conundrums, all kinds of places where I ran, where I became unsure of myself, where I wasn't sure what the hell I was doing. And for many indigenous people around the world, research is a super dirty word, because Native people have been measured, have been categorized, have been objectified for all kinds of reasons, essentially colonialist reasons, for all kinds of years and for all kinds of reasons with all kinds of kind of gross kind of outcomes. So many times if you talk about doing research, Native people rightly say, you know, screw off, which actually kind of approximates my stance, because in running this thistle for all these years, and I kid you not, probably once a week, maybe more, I get somebody from a local university saying they want to come down and do a study with our kids. And they're always nice, and they're always polite, and they always have quasi-liberal intentions. And they always want to do a study. They want to do a study on street-involved Native youth. They want to do involved in sex work-involved street youth. Or they want to do a study on economic indicators for low-income youth or whatever. There's endless kind of studies that they want to do. They're always calling me about this stuff. And literally to a person, I say no. And I say no for a whole bunch of reasons. One is I don't want our kids being objectified. They're people. They're not objects for your study. Secondly, what's in it for them? Because really, as far as I understand it, it's a stepping stone towards your quasi-lucrative academic career. And you don't have any relationship with these kids, so what's in it for them? And thirdly, like, no, screw off. Like, we're busy, we got stuff we're doing on, and can tell us why we should help you. But the answer I always offer back to them is, you know what, if you would like to come and start a project at the Thistle, if you would like to start something, if you'd like to run any kind of project with them, if you'd like to come start a class, a workshop, take them out, if you'd like to give a lecture, fucking awesome, come and do that, and then write about it, write about your experiences, and that would be great. You know, or you don't have to do anything. If you don't like organizing, you know, if you're a student or whatever, and you don't like talking to people, then come and clean the bathrooms. Just hang around for a while and then talk about what you saw. And literally, after 8 years now, I've got zero. I got zero people taking me up on that. I got tons of volunteers. We get all kinds of volunteers coming. We get people who always want to come and do stuff, and that's great. But never once have I ever had one of those graduate students take me up on that and the sort of implicit participatory research kind of invitation, which is fine. It's all good. And I got, I don't have any beef against grad students per se. But certainly then, I feel particularly cautious and occasionally really quite anxious about when I think, say, that I'm doing research based out of these trips. Because I think much of that kind of liberal research kind of rubric is based on this idea that, well, I'm a good liberal, and I'm doing study, and I'm kind of doing kind of research, so it must be good. I'm a good person, so what I must be doing, therefore, is good. It's for the betterment of the world. And I think that kind of generalized kind of rationale is extremely suspect, and oftentimes just straight up disingenuous. And I think that much of that kind of rubric also has at its foundation an intellectual commitment to the idea of tolerance, which I think to me is really the close brethren of intolerance in a lot of ways. I think tolerance invokes a polite distaste, oftentimes a swamping or a willful ignorance of historical constructions, a commitment to a liberal kind of multiculturalism that doesn't acknowledge genuine difference. And so within all of that, I'll come back to that in a second, but within all of that, I have a suspicion when I say I'm starting to do some research and starting to do some talking about these experiences I've had in the North. And equally, another kind of trajectory in that is that I of course, like I'm sure all of you, have a distinct suspicion of tourism. And I am unclear very often if what we were doing is tourism. And for native people and people living on the land, all over the world, tourism is among the most corrosive kind of pieces by which Western culture arrives and begins to do its destructive little thing. And so I'm suspicious about whether or not that we are leaving Western values behind, whether we're just taken and not leaving anything. I'm wondering about our motives for going there, and my motives in particular. So as one of the parents of one of the kids when we got in the plane said, oh, okay, now you guys can check off that box that says North, as if the world was one sort of large series of boxes that you have to, you know, check those places to go before you die. And I was like, well, not really. It's not really that thing. But certainly, I mean, all of us have thought about it and encountered that, this degree to which Western, and in my case, Southern, inquisitiveness so easily turns into acquisitiveness, and of how that trajectory appears to be so common and so easy for us to fall into. And within all of that, so those are all, and even more than that, and even one other kind of like frame for this, is that in all, and I've been looking for a long time, and I would love to find it, but I have yet to find any other project that explicitly gets Native and non-Native kids together. And that's really the core of our project, is to try to figure out ways to get Native kids to spend time with non-Native kids, and to do that in a way that is both useful and sensitive and interesting for all of us. Because the North-South thing is incredibly interesting for all of us in Canada, because there's, for all the obvious reasons, and the small-town, big-city thing is interesting in all kinds of ways. But really the core part of our kind of what we're after here is the Native-non-Native intersection. Because in Canada, that colonialist narrative is one which, of course, has never been resolved anything close to adequately, but is an everyday reality of our lives and is an incredibly prevalent one in Vancouver in particular, but all over British Columbia and all over Canada, which is to say that maybe the dominant narrative of the Canadian state has been founded on stolen land and has been founded on colonialist genocide. So given all that, and given all that kind of frame, frankly speaking, I'm trying to figure out what the hell we're doing and whether or not that intersection is worth pursuing. Because then every time I try to think my way out of, yeah, please just make yourself at home, man. Come, don't worry about it, just find a seat or whatever. Every time I try to think about that, I keep on finding myself running into these kind of blind alleys and kind of trap doors of imperialist kind of insensitivity. And I continually keep kind of confounding myself. About what we bring, about what we assume, about how to pull this off and if it's valuable. And I can go into that a bit more, but except to say that for me, it's interesting in all kinds of ways, except that in Canada in particular, where I live in particular, on the east side of Vancouver, which has a fairly concentrated urban Native population, that Native-non-Native intersection is not going away. We can't unpop that balloon of colonialism. And so what then? So given that reality and given all those problematics, what then? How to approach decolonization or social justice, or how to support self-determination in a way that isn't inherently corrosive? And so that piece has led me to try to stay with it and to try to stay, not necessarily with this project, although I'm still hanging in there with it, but to think about it in larger terms of decolonization, and in particular this case of how do Native and non-Native people spend time together. And I guess that the piece that's kind of led me out of that in some ways, to the extent that I feel okay about standing here in front of you guys, is really simple, and is particularly not very interesting in some ways, but in other ways very interesting to me, and that's just simple friendship. At core, when I get myself intellectually in these kind of in these boxes about how to approach it, and how a relatively middle-class white dude from Vancouver ends up dealing with privilege and ends up dealing with this intersection, the part of it that I just keep returning to is just friendship. So when I call up and I say, I'm thinking about, putting in an application for another set of funding, and it's just so great to hear them and talk to them. We talk on the phone pretty much weekly with people, and to hear just the general good times that we have, right? All the funny times that we have together and all the absurd times that we've had together. And every time I go up there, just straight up how glad I am to see them, And I don't know if that's reciprocated, but every time I ask about it, if we want to do it again, everybody seems to be into it. So that's the piece I'm kind of clinging to. And it's a particular piece, and I'm trying to define it as something that is a very different imperative or a very different motivation than just simple liberal notions of tolerance and multiculturalism and what is good. And I'm going to read you two things that kind of helped me out a lot. The first one is by this guy who I super admire and been working with a little bit, a guy called Gustavo Esteva, who is a Mexican intellectual who lives south of Oaxaca now. He works in a small Zapotec village. He's one of the architects of the Zapatista revolutions, and is just a genuinely cool dude. He writes this. He says, "Tolerance could never embrace. It suffers differences instead of being hospitable to them. Though more gentle or discreet, tolerance is merely a different form of intolerance. Toleration, Goethe observed, ought in reality to be merely a transitory mood. It must lead to recognition. To tolerate is to insult. Hospitality, in contrast, embraces the radical pluralism of reality, the incommensurable otherness of the other. Hospitality means opening your arms and the doors of your heart to those who are radically different." And there's a bunch in there that I like, and a bunch of words in there that I've kind of been torn with that I think are really useful in all kinds of ways. But I kind of, at some time when I began to think about this and to talk with Gustavo about this, is that phrase of hospitality. I find it's kind of a weird word, because in my world, it kind of seems like one of them courses you take at a community college to learn to run like a cheap motel, like a hospitality management or something. But I think there's something in that word hospitality that I've clung to and I find real important. And Gustavo, in that piece or whatever, he was building on this guy, Ivan Illich, who began to speak about hospitality about 20 years ago. And I'm going to read you another small piece from Ivan. He says, "I do think that if I had to choose one word to which hope can be tied, it's hospitality. A practice of hospitality, recovering threshold, table, patience, listening, and from there generating seedbeds for virtue and friendship on the one hand, on the other radiating out for possible community, for rebirth of community." So that part there, that piece of hospitality based on friendship and based on a rejection of the insult of tolerance, is the part where I've begun to kind of stick with. You'll forgive my flakiness, I'm from the left coast, but that part about opening the doors to your heart, it kind of resonates with me, but not in a general way, in a more specific way of opening the doors to your dinner table. That is to say that I think the practice of sharing place, of sharing house, of staying with people, of inviting people to stay with you, and maybe even on a more prosaic level, of just sharing meals with people. That experience of sharing food with people, of sharing a freshly caught caribou, of trying to cook food together, and of all the fun that happens out of that. For example, just a very brief story was that in the last exchange we were coming back, we all went out to a swimming pool out in the suburbs, one of those big swimming pools with like slides and shit all over the place. And of course it was great for everybody. And we were coming back from that pool, everybody gets hungry, right? So we're driving back in from the kind of suburban part of Vancouver to downtown, and everybody's hungry. You know what you get when you get a whole bunch of teenagers and all hungry at the same time. Like, they're all arguing about where to go like crazy, right? And then we're driving through this. There's a South Asian part of town. It's called Little India, and it's kind of a it's a real big area. And it's just all of a sudden you drive through it, and it's just like an endless series of South Asian stores and restaurants and stuff. And we know it as my family knows it as because there's all these great big huge buffets right out there. At 10 bucks you get a full vegetarian buffet, and it's all you can eat Indian food. So my kid actually was on the last exchange. My 7-year-old goes, "Hey, yeah, let's go for all you can eat Indian food." Everybody's like, "Yeah, right on, all you can eat Indian food, right?" And so we all pull in, right? We all pull in the thing, and all the native folk from Good Hope are like, "What the fuck is this?" It's all like, it's fucking naan and like lentils and shit, right? There's no fucking meat. It's not fucking Indian food. What are you talking about? Right? So you know, and that stuff, and then the problem that happens after that, of course, of like our kids, you know, hassling them and getting them meat chilies and stuff like that, and them rushing around. Downing Cokes to try to kill the taste, and the line up to the bathroom after eating spicy naan. You know, the whole thing, the whole part of it, right? That whole part of sharing a meal and sharing food, I think, begins to lay.
Burning feeling.
Yeah, that special warm feeling in certain nether regions begins to lay some of those seabeds for friendship, right? And I, in particular, I've begun to kind of cling to that in some ways because of the. And I never really got this until. Just make yourself at home if you'll. Just sit on the floor, whatever you got. The things, because I've really never, in my own dopey way, I never really understood how critical that is, in particular to kind of land-based cultures, which is to say that.
I think maybe your cord got sat on.
Yeah, I think maybe you unplugged that. If you could, that's all good. No fears. If you could mess around and see if you can plug that back in, something that'd be awesome. If not, don't worry about it. That when you're. It'll come back to us. Is that when you're, particularly in the north, so in general, but it's the town that we're staying in, this town called Fort Good Hope, they're one of four communities in Satu Dene territory. And the Satu have lived there for approximately 30,000 years, they guess, the time out of mind or time immemorial or forever. And there, I don't know what the requisite or what the comparable size is around here. I'm going to say New England, but at least the bottom two-thirds of British Columbia, this massive, massive, massive area that covers all the way from Great Bear Lake all the way over to the mountains. There's 1,600 people that live in four communities there. And that's about what the Satu population has been for 30,000 years. And the way that they move, the way they find settlement, the way that they conceive of their lives is all built around semi-nomadic traveling and finding food. And so to share food, to sit down and eat something with folks is fundamental. It's right at the heart of how they conceive of their lives and how they conceive of their patterns of movement and the seasons. So to be able to share food and to be able to share a house and be able to have people stay with each other strikes me as the very simplest part, which is in some ways very simple and very kind of modest and humble. But in other ways, seems to me, is the place where an actual politics could flourish. It's that point where it feels like I might have some kind of vague idea about what decolonization might look like. And I guess that the last part I would finish with, and I often speak about it, but Cornel West said this cool thing one time. He said that there's this distinct difference between optimism and hope. And he said if you were an optimistic person in the world that we live in, you know, you're not looking very far, very hard. Pretty difficult to be an optimistic person given what we're facing today. But hope, he said, that's a different deal altogether. He said, optimism is a spectatorial quality. It's looking on and going, yeah, I'm pretty sure things are going to be okay. Hope is another deal altogether. That's a participatory quality. And I think that if we were to take a radical pluralism seriously and to think about decolonization in the context of self-determination, I think it's contingent upon us to reject the implied and even explicit insult of toleration, of tolerance, and its political antecedents of multiculturalism, and look again towards some kind of radical pluralism of self-determination. And to me, that thinking about that, I think it's friendship that begins to lay those seeds that we maybe be able to build the politics out of. I'm going to stop there. Thank you, guys. Thanks for your time. Thank you. Awesome. So, So we got some time, so why don't we just hang out? But if anybody has any kind of technological capacity, I have some other photos that I'd be happy to show. I mean, not a lot, but another dozen photos. And if anybody feels free to try to get them up again, that'd be awesome. Yes, ma'am, please.
So, Mike, you were talking about the exchange happens. You bring the kids from the faraway town to Vancouver?
Yes.
And then you bring some kids from Vancouver over there? Or how?
That's correct. I'm sorry. I explained that inadequately. Yeah. So we take about 12 kids from each town. We match them up in pairs. We bring the whole crew from Good Hope down to Vancouver for 2 weeks. And then they match up in pairs. They stay in each other's houses.
Yeah.
And then we do the reverse. Now, in both towns, because almost everybody's real low income, we don't always, it's not always a direct pair. Some people don't have enough room, or sometimes the houses are too sketchy, or sometimes people don't want a house. So sometimes we double or triple them up. And ends up usually like about 6 to 10 people staying in my house, just so they like to all pile together. But that's the general idea, is people staying in each other's houses and spending time with each other.
Sharing meals.
That's it. And then we build all the kinds of other kinds of, you know, cultural experiences that you might think. So there's a bunch of good Native activists in my part of town who run a newspaper and run a magazine, and there's like, you know, hip hop folks we bring. And we do all that stuff. Then we usually do community service. So this time there's a urban Native garden we worked on for 4 days together, and that kind of, you know, just anything we could think of to do. But also the group in our case, I'm not exactly sure how consistent it is. Well, it's pretty consistent up there, but we do it a little differently in Vancouver, in that we get the kids about 8 months together, beforehand about 8 months together, and talk about stuff. We, you know, watch videos, talk about colonialism, bring in speakers, talk about that, you know, that kind of stuff.
Matt, I'm going to reboot this.
Sure.
Okay.
Great. You're going to wipe out everything on my flash drive then?
Maybe.
Perfect. Great. Okay. Good. That's the kind of loose model. And then we throw in anything we can. So 1 year I took them all surfing on the west coast of British Columbia in November. We took them all surfing, and it was great. That was totally fun. Just something goofy to do. Yeah. Oh, you're genius. Thank you. Thanks. I'll show the last couple pictures. If you guys got any, feel free just to jump in with comments or questions. Or really. You can see that picture. That's funny. That guy right there, that's Nigel. He's a 14-year-old guy. It looks to me like he just got screwed. Oh my God, what happened? Why did I lose my money? Yeah. We don't bring a whole lot of money, but it's a fun time. And they say put your hands under the coats like that and shake them around and stuff. Actually a member of parliament. That's it there. So we spent a lot of time going fishing. I'm not sure if anybody ever seen the Mackenzie River? I mean, it's just an enormous river. That's actually kind of a narrow part. So that thing over there on the left, that's actually an island. And that's it pretty much. It's almost all frozen to the edge. So, and you see this whole kind of wide kind of strip around it. That's all because I don't know if anybody been on a frozen river. But when it freezes, it just cracks and comes up like this. And it makes, so anytime when it's freezing or unfreezing, maybe you've seen this, but it makes this just incredible noise, creaking noise for like 6 months as it freezes and unfreezes. And it pushes all the way up that, like you can see how far that is, all the way up that beach or whatever on either side. And oftentimes you get chunks of ice coming up into the basketball court in town. It's up there. So that's us going fishing, driving the thing down and taking off. That's us. We went camping for 2 weeks and we were smoking a bunch of fish we caught. That's the teepees and stuff. And I guess it kind of goes without saying. Those are the wood stoves you pull in these tents when you go on the land. There's a number of things I would just add in there. So I'm going to get the next picture. I can't really see it. I can't tell you how freaking cold it was there. At this point, it's like early October. Like it's just badass to be up there and you're going fishing, right? So I'm like, all right, here we go. Let's get it on. And you can see there, the other thing about the north that's so common, and many of you have probably experienced this too, you see that right here there's a name on it? It's not the person whose life jacket's borrowing, it's the person who died in that life jacket. And so the amount of tragedy, of violence, of just plain old just sadness that happens in north, I think it's very endemic across northern towns. Good Hope is kind of famous in some ways because it has by virtually every socioeconomic indicator, but also statistics about crime and violence. It's just catastrophically higher than almost anywhere else in the Northwest Territories, which is itself catastrophically higher than almost anywhere in the South. So the violent crime rate for adolescent males is 88 per 100 annually, which means to say that 88% or 88 of 100 males in Good Hope are involved in a criminally recorded with a violent act, but also tragedy. So in the last 6 years we did this, three kids from our exchanges have committed suicide, and two others have died in crashes. And one of a regular way to die is to fall in the river, because the river is so cold and so fast, and it's not really survivable. So you get in these things. This is a very common thing. You get in this thing. It's a name. There's a, I don't know if you can see it there. It's a little tag in it with a picture of AD on it. Here we go, and out there in this freaking blizzard. And there you go. And that's me saying goodbye. My oldest kid is actually on that boat, so it's like feeling a little anxious. That's her there. So that's this guy, Michelle. I don't know if you can quite get this, but with his bare hands pulling these fish out of the water that we've caught. We used to lay a net and pull these fish out of the water. I can't tell you how badass it is. Like, even looking at him pulling out makes me so confused. So, but dudes, I mean, not to be overly cliched about it, but there's a certain kind of like hardiness to survive in the North. So on this trip, actually, I went out just for one day with one of the kids in exchange. He took me out to a strap line with his dad. Right in the snow, a little bit. We drove about 70 kilometers out of town. They built a little shack way up in the middle of nowhere. And what they do is they run about 50 kilometers of traps, of muskrat trap lines, just straight up this kind of cut line. And they're these little traps. They have no idea how they work. And they're just a little piece of metal. I have no idea how they catch muskrats. They just, you know, catch them and snap their neck. But I have no idea why a muskrat in the middle of nowhere would walk in. But they do. So they set these lines one day. And then the next day you put them, you come back. And the next day you come back. And so if you're really lucky, you're gonna get some. Because if any wolf with any half a brain is going to hit that trap line and just work its way down, right? Like a buffet, right? Just eating all the muskrats that have been caught, right? So you got to get there before the wolves get there. But if you get there, unless you're just like spectacularly lucky, they're frozen like a rock, eh? Like they're just, you know, frozen, frozen, frozen. So what we do is you take them off out of the traps, you throw them in this thing, you drive in this canvas bag, and you drive back to town. And then what you do is you take, their cabin's good, it's got a big heater and stuff like that. But what they do is they take, they lay these boughs down at the bottom, and then they take some blankets. You take the bottom couple of blankets, you lift them up, and you throw all the muskrats underneath there. See, you know, like 30 or 40 muskrats. You throw them in there, you put your blankets down on top, and you sleep on top of them. So, because your body thaws them out, eh? So you're sleeping on a pile of fucking muskrats? Are you kidding me? your body heat thaws them out, and then you pull them out, they're soft enough for you to skin them outside, right? Because then they're, because even when you're skinning a thing, even you make a little like cut around the eye, you ruffle the fur, then the price drops, right? So they're about $60 a rat to start with, and then you can get, like, if you screw it up, you don't get much. So there's quite a bit of incentive to get it right? So you just kind of, stuff like that, you're just like, you know, I'm the softest dude in the world, you know what I mean? Like, I don't even know how you guys do this. And they just talk about, it's just a normal kind of, I mean, it's good and it works. There you go, this is, they call that an Econ-Miller, a coney. These big fish. You can see that, once again, I don't know who that is, but you can see the name on the thing. Let's come back. That's a barge, because of course, when you're 350 miles away from the road, most of your stuff gets trucked in a barge coming by. That says we actually went to hunt, so that's a whole bunch of moose meat there, and fish that's hanging up to dry.
Oh, there's Keith.
That's Keith, there you go. Yeah, you know Keith. So that's Keith is, he went on one of the first exchanges as a kid, and then now I hired him to bring back as a group leader the other day. That's a big chunk of meat, moose he's got in his hand. Actually, on that trip too, we were drying it all outside and smoking it outside in his teepee, which got a hole in the top. So I was just standing there, and this big chunk of ice fell on my head, you know, and it kind of went down my face. And then, but I was just standing there by the fire, and then I realized that it was kind of salty, and I realized it was not snow. It was a big chunk of moose goo that had fallen on me, and I was like, oh yeah. This is kind of how it gets for a fragile little vegan from the South, right? I was like, okay. So I just went to bed, you know, and after that, I went to bed, and I realized in the middle of the night I had my toque pulled down to keep warm, you know, and I had this, like, sopping moose goo piece of toque on my face, you know? I was like, yeah, there it is. That's it. I was like, well, it's a little snack in the middle of the night if I get hungry, you know? Suck on that. Yeah. That's us out in the cabin out there. I think I'm almost done. That's us learning to gut fish properly, which is fun because this woman's great, but she's a She does it once, like at warp speed, and then says, "You do it." And you go, "I'm not sure." She says, "I just showed you, didn't I?" That's teenagers getting tired of being outside. They call it out in the bush. They don't want to be out in the bush anymore. They want to come back, go back to town. Which is a funny kind of conundrum that happens, of course, all the time, is because so many teenagers there don't have requisite bush skills anymore. And so there's an incredible collision. And that, of course, is one of the key pieces of my concern, right, is by taking kids to the South and presumably showing them a good time and having a good time, are we contributing to kids having a disinterest in learning bush skills? And there's all kinds of collisions like that, but many times that they're, in my case, you know, they're also bound up with all kinds of really kind of fucked up and weird romantic notions of how Native people should be living, you know. So when one time I was talking with Frank about this, and I said, you know, because they only got phones and stuff in the 60s, and I said, when did you guys stop hunting with dog teams, you know? When did you stop hunting with dog teams? And he just looked at me, because it was actually in the mid-70s when they turned it over to snowmobile hunting. He just looked at me, he was like, as soon as I could. Obviously, it's fucking 48 below out there. Like, you want to go with the dog team? They die out there in the cold, right? And so while in my kind of simple, naive notions about what was, you know, how they should be living, he was like, some of the same questions asking me why I don't drive a horse and buggy anymore. You know, it's like, well, obviously, because it's not as good. You know what I mean? And so those notions are all bound up, because sometimes, you know, people in the South decry how folks in the North are losing their traditions or whatever, right? Well, yeah, so and so are we. You know, cultures are evolving just like any other culture, right? And so much of that, too, I don't think you've, that's a picture of swastika. I don't think I got it properly in that picture. So much of that of like how, about bush skills and about how people should be living or whatever, are bound up with totally weird romantic notions about how, you know, people living on the land, and particularly indigenous people, should be living. But of course, they're just like any rest of us, right? I just talked to somebody up there the other day, and for three solid weeks, it was minus 49 average, right? You know, when you're out there in that weather, you know, you change your, you do what you can to stay warm. You bring your canvas tents, you bring your stuff, you do what you gotta do. I think that's the end of the photos.
How many years does the exchange program go?
We started in 2002, so this will be year 7 we're going to do this year. We've tried to do it annually, but it hasn't happened like that because the funding was so brutal. So this will be number 5 that's coming up this fall.
Do you ever get to hear from some of the earliest participants?
Yeah, I do.
Doing stuff collaboratively or taking an interest in...
I did. You know what I did? I did a long kind of a kind of quasi longitudinal study with lots of them. And lots of them I know, and just are, you know, whether it's my house still. You know, I see the guy Keith. I see Keith. I see, you know, people all the time who are on early exchanges. And much of the question I ask is like, you know, I ask kind of quasi political leading questions, like, has it ever, you know, have you ever gotten involved in indigenous support struggles since then? Have you felt more comfortable? Would you feel more comfortable going to? Because there's like, you know, all around our house, like in the parks, there's powwows, you know, fairly regularly and stuff. Would you feel like going? Would you feel more comfortable? And the answer covers the whole swath of things, you know, of yes, yeah, some and some no, you know. But more interest to me is, have you stayed in connection? Have you stayed in contact with people? Has that friendship lasted? And one of the things that led me to do some further study and writing on this is the answer is not really. Because it's a one-time thing. But this is one of the most troubling things, is of course when you live in a busy immigrant city in the South, that you run into all these kind of, you know, intercultural kind of things. They end up, so for like my daughter, for example, right, she perceives the exchange, one awesome thing, she loves it, but there's going to be this whole long series of cool things and cool people she's going to meet, right? For the last 25 years, statistically speaking, immigration to Fort Good Hope has been zero. Nobody moves there. There's one Japanese exchange student or volunteer there, and there's one guy, funnily enough, a Jamaican dude, an RCMP officer, who got immediately posted after he got his citizenship and got through the academy, got posted to Fort Good Hope, which is kind of a drag for him. He had this 3-year posting. He's a good guy. He's funny about it. But they don't have a ton of kind of other encounters, right? So kids in the South, they perceive that their lives are, like many of us, are going to be a whole long series of kind of funky things happening. In Good Hope, there's 550 people, and not a lot of people come through. So that's a pretty seminal experience for me, and they don't get that opportunity to go out. So when you leave them, like, there's all this stuff. Like, many of the kids from Good Hope talk about, okay, you're family now, you're my cousin, we're going to stay in touch, you're going to come here again next year, right? I'm going to come down and stay with you. Like, there's a sort of a disproportionate kind of attachment. part of that is just simply because they're kids from a small town. They don't meet a lot of other people, right? And so they're thrilled, and we have a good time. But that's one of the pieces that's kind of sad to me in a lot of ways, is that's not really requited, right? I mean, the kids from the South are nice, and they return their, you know, Facebook messages and shit, but they're, it's just not the same level of importance in some way, right? And no, that's not entirely true, and that's a bit kind of paternalistic to say in some ways. But in other ways, there is a differential, like, kind of where that fits in the number of experiences you've had, right? Because even poor kids, you know, like Vancouver, there's 43% of the city. I wasn't born in Canada, right? So you end up running into all kinds of different people just sitting around, and there's just a, you know, it's just, you're just more, there's just a bigger volume. There's 2 million people in Vancouver. It's just a volume of experiences the kids have that you're just not going to get in the North, right? Of that kind of humane experience or whatever. So that's a long, long answer to your question, which is, yeah, kind of, and I don't know. It's the answer to the question. Whether or not it's sensitized people, kids, I don't know. Yeah. Yes, ma'am.
What sort of a specific Indigenous support what has the relationship developed into outside of exchanges?
I don't know a lot.
What
How's
do you
that?
Feel about that?
I don't know. If there was something I thought that we could do, like in terms of kind of structural thing, yeah. I mean, of course, for sure. But we do stuff like, you know, we do like write letters or whatever. We send stuff. And I helped the band camps a lot with grant writing and stuff and hook them up and stuff. But the biggest problem right now in Good Hope is that, I don't know if you can imagine it geographically, but there's from the Beaufort Sea, as long as I've been alive, they've been talking about the Beaufort Sea is having all this oil and gas, right? And so there's 2 competing pipelines, and one of the main ones, they want to bring, the Mackenzie Valley Pipeline Group, they want to bring it down, right down the Mackenzie Valley. So it's because, of course, it's warmer by the river, right? So they want to bring it all the way down. It would go through about 5 different band territories, among them the Satu Dene territory. It's like a $13 billion project. It's the Mackenzie Valley Explorers Group is Conoco, Exxon, BP, and a few others that are involved there, right? So they've been trying for about 20 years. They first tried to do it in the 70s, and it was rejected. But they're trying to get it, and interestingly enough, the Good Hope Band Council is one of the very last groups of people that haven't agreed yet. And so they're kind of at the pinpoint of all this kind of like pressure, right, from this incredible number of like lawyers and lobbyists and people who come up to try to get them to sign off on this. And so it's really one of the interesting pieces is that the town is poor as hell. There's no particular job prospects. You know, the town is, there's no real kind of external kind of income that to be had. And what the Mackenzie Valley Pipeline Group has is a guarantee of perpetual income perpetual employment for anybody who wants it, plus straight up $110,000 for every man, woman, and child right now. That's the offer on the table. So for a family of 5 or 6 or whatever, it's a rather considerable amount of money. And so you talk to Frank about that, and he's like, well, my people have been here for 30,000 years. What happens when this pipeline comes to you? What even happens if a road gets built? You know, that's a whole other deal again. But people are poor. People are broke. I mean, $110,000. I mean, someone offers you $110,000. It's not something to sneeze at, right?
Depends on what they want in return.
Yeah. Well, it's essentially a pipeline running right down, right? And so you talk. And so many times you talk with you know, I sit around because I spend a lot of time just sitting around with the elders council up there, and they just having coffee and just talking kind of informally. And to them, they've been there for 30,000 years. Right? They've been there forever. And so 150 years or, you know, 400 years of colonialism in North America and 150 years of contact up there, it's just this little kind of fucked up little blip, right? To their mind, they just kind of see this little tiny blip, and that's just, you know, the Satu Dene will always be here. We're always going to be here. We're always going to thrive. This is our land. We've always been a land. That's just the way it's going to be. Doesn't matter how bad things are right now. They have this kind of, like, extremely long-term historical perspective. And I totally admire that and love it. And you and I know that, you know, there's, like, indigenous languages that are disappearing all over the world. And they're disappearing. They're not, you know, disappearing for a little bit. They're going away. You know, the languages are disappearing. You know that indigenous people are dissipating. You know that actual extinction does happen. And with 1,600 people, I mean, a good-sized diamond mine, which has been proposed for further west from them, a good-sized diamond mine employs 1,600 people. With the road in, it's highly possible that the Satu Dene people could just kind of filter away. So the answer here, long as your question, is not really. We don't do a ton of it, except that we try to have communication. We help wherever they can, and they don't particularly need a whole lot of support with that, you know, in large respect. The one piece they do want is they want kids to be able to come to the South and get some kind of skills to go back and be able to negotiate. Because you know how hard it is, even when some, you know, low-grade lawyer comes and talks to you, how easily it is to get confused and like, okay, what's going on here? I don't know what's happening, you know, just for us. But if you could imagine somebody from the north with the best lawyers that Exxon's money could buy descending upon you en masse and all of a sudden talking your ear off, then it's difficult to kind of get your bearings, right? And so what they really want is they want people to come south, get some kind of training, and then go north. And so we've been trying to facilitate that in some of our people come to my house and I take people for tours and help them get in. But that's about as far as I got so far. Yes, ma'am.
It's really great to see the work you're doing. I came late, but it feels like you're putting some emphasis on building relationships, and I think that's really important because often in the activist world you get like lost in like theory, or we overlook the importance of relationships. I think it's important to put the affinity back in the affinity group. But relationships take time, and you have to get beyond barriers and build trust. That's really the foundation of resistance. So it's good to be reminded. And from reading the description in the program, we use a lot of words like multiculturalism and a lot of like buzzwords. So I wasn't exactly sure what angle you were going to approach it from, but you didn't spend so much time on theory anyway. But I guess I just personally feel like we're too often expected to be tolerant of intolerance, make waves and stuff or whatever. So I kind of came here from that.
Right, yeah. No, I hear it. I just think that there's good reason to be suspicious of that word, of toleration, right? It actually has a medieval kind of connotation, the word does, toleration. I mean, literally, so historically speaking, it was initially a part of the Catholic Church's kind of edict about what other religions would they be tolerated, which other religions would they allow. Mm-hmm. And there actually is, to me, a very distinct tendency when you start thinking about tolerance, but also particularly in terms of when it gets reflected in official Canadian governmental policy around multiculturalism and stuff, of, okay, we're just kind of all equal and we're all just going to kind of have equal access to this culture, you know? The one that just ignores historical constructions, right? Ignores, you know, historical inequalities, ignores kind of the past and says, well, now we're all just kind of in an equal kind of, you know, happy society here and everybody can just, we can all just kind of get along, can't we? And an expectation of a conflation or some kind of liberal consensus, right? That we all kind of just, you know, we're all just kind of people, we'll all just kind of share our liberal values.
Or corporate consensus, like we all eat at McDonald's.
Yeah, or in some ways, but Canada's reflected in this very strange language in official governmental policy, right? And to me, that begins to gloss over actual difference, right? The fact that people, thankfully, in our world, have very different values than we do. That they speak different languages, they look differently, they think differently, they act differently, and thank goodness for that. Right? And we need to be able to preserve that, not to try to collapse it into some kind of false consensus, right? But to me, that's what toleration begins to invoke, right? In part with this kind of polite distaste. Well, I don't really like the way you live, and it's kind of, you know, weird, but I'm just going to kind of like let you be over there, right? I think that's very different than hospitality or understanding or actual, you know, really calls it recognition, but actually, you know, acknowledging a radical pluralism, right? Mm-hmm. That is to say that we live in a very world full of difference, and we shouldn't try to gloss that over that, and we shouldn't try to collapse it. Does that make kind of some sense? Yes, please, sir.
Yes, I'm sorry, I arrived very late. But
yeah, I'm going to hold that against you.
Sorry. but this is a point I what you were just talking about, why I came to this, because I think it's a very interesting point about the title of your lecture expresses that tolerance is also a buzzword, and it sounds like, oh, okay, if a society is tolerant, that's cool and enough and fine, and I think similarly about this to what you described, and it seems to me, but can be a question that would you agree that and of course others as well, that in fact the real thing is an appreciation of the diversity. So not only tolerating that there are other communities as well. I am from Budapest, Hungary, so for example, not only tolerate the presence of Gypsy Hungarians or Jewish Hungarians or other minorities,
sure.
but recognize diversity as the as as a cherished value of the society. So is this what you are?
You got it. You're on it, and it's about telling me how do you move further beyond that, right? And what does tolerance invoke, right? When you say you're against tolerance, you're getting into tricky territory, right? Right away. I mean, deliberately kind of saying it like that to be cute or whatever, but it's being suspicious. A pleasure. Thank you. Being suspicious of the ideals of tolerance and what are behind them should not invoke intolerance, right? It's the opposite of that. It's like, how do we move beyond tolerance, right? And what kind of ways do the official notions and official renditions of tolerance actually keep people in their place, you know? In what ways do they actually begin to socially reproduce orders that have already been constructed for us, right? And I think that's the piece to that, right, is that I'm most after, right? Yeah, appreciation, yeah, recognition. And the part that seems to me to be, like I've suggested, most useful is this idea of hospitality to me, of trying to build a politics out of friendship, to start simple.
And is it working in Vancouver or in Canada? Because it seems that the U.S. is a society where diversity is not only sort of tolerated or accepted, but appreciated and recognized as the source of the strength of U.S. society, or probably the main source of strength. So that's the self-image of the United States. Is it similar in Canada to some extent?
No, it's not working at all in Canada. No, I mean, Native people by any single economic indicator you wanted to dredge up, they're much poorer off than virtually any other, you know, group that you could generate, right? Many Native people live on reservations with not adequate running water, with completely inadequate housing, with no, you know, open sewage, et cetera, et cetera, right? So, no, and despite Canadians, you know, sort of cherished and much lauded kind of ideas about our northern, you know, benevolence, and that we're just really nice people, right? There's still like unbelievable levels of A, poverty, but B, just kind of inequality, right? And my argument would be that official renditions of tolerance and multiculturalism are specifically designed to keep that in place. Yes, sir.
I'm wondering if I can spur on some thoughts for you, about the idea of diversity. I've been like in different grassroots groups where people look at the group and they measure if it's healthy or not on how diverse it is, from like, you know, how many women do we have, how many men do we have, how many black people do we have, how many white people we have, and judge it if it is along one line, or say that it's very, or like heard this this sort of discussion about anarchist people of color being very separatist for staying along that line. I'm just wondering if you can spur on some thoughts about this multiculturalism and diversity in groups. You know, any general thoughts from what I'm saying?
Do I have any general thoughts?
Yeah, like how about the healthiness or unhealthiness of a group on how diverse it is?
I don't know. There's a whole bunch that's kind of embedded in what you're talking about there.
Right.
I would just say one thing is that, you know, anarchists often find themselves organizing with all white groups or whatever, and
right.
That's fucked up, and they should look hard at that. you know, look really hard and long and sincerely about who you're organizing with in all kinds of ways, right? But diversity is some kind of self-congratulatory kind of sort of platitudinous, like, well, this is good because it's a diverse group, is also not true, right? I mean, that's not right either, right? But I think every part of, I think every time, at every level and every part of organizing, we should be looking at our privilege and figuring out who you're doing it for and what are you doing it for. And I keep, when I do that with myself, the times doesn't come particularly easy to me, you know, to encounter humility. It's not my natural default setting, I'm afraid. I keep finding these kind of back doors and trap doors for myself, right? Where, what exactly, how am I doing that, right? And are you sure that you're a force for good? Are you sure that just because you're a nice, like, white dude trying to get Native kids and white kids together, are you sure that's a good idea? Are you sure that's working? And what exactly are your motivations there? I think that the more we can ask ourselves those questions, not ideologically or dogmatically, but actually I think the more likely we are to be able to come to some kind of actual honesty about our organizing. I'm not sure that answers your question, but let me see if we can get around to it.
A couple of things. One is, you know, there's some things that I think really, some good essays that really touch on this subject that I think are pretty good. Perhaps you read them. One is by Esteva and Madhusuri Prakash from was it Liberation of, was it From a Pedagogy of Liberation to Liberation of from Pedagogy.
Are you doing me a favor and trying to promote the book I'm going to put on the table later? That essay is actually in a book that I'll put on the table and very kind of shyly try to sell afterwards.
Okay.
It's one of my very favorite essays. But thank you for that's my agent over there for anybody.
And the other, there are two other texts that I think that kind of address this issue of the problem with tolerance, which I don't hear much about, talked in our circles very much. It's by Stanley Fish. The Trouble with Principle is one. There's No Such Thing as Free Speech is another, which kind of, you know, the way I see it is that, you know, multiculturalism is sort of an institutionalized form of what this was originally intended to be, you know, the spirit of friendship. It became ossified. It became institutionalized. It was in response to the it was a product of the Enlightenment and all the counter-reformations and reformations and, you know, all the battles, theological debates that were going on back in later part. And this is sort of in response to it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's, I mean, just kind of historically deconstructing it, I think that's where the origins come from.
Do you have a lot of official multiculturalism policy around here? Like in Vancouver and in Canada, it's just embedded in almost everything, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But it's just got this really weird kind of patina of paternalism.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know?
Yeah.
But
how do you think it endangers the goal, what you described? You mentioned that you think that this sort of official policy is part of the problem. Why? Because multicultural, I mean, I'm not saying that it's not.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to, because it's a enshrined value in the constitution in Canada. It provides a reason to restrict freedom of speech even in several cases in order to protect the value.
Sure. I'm going to say a half second. Did we cut you off, sir?
No,
I can't cut you off.
Just some thoughts I had about, where that's coming from. That's what happens with institutions in general. It's like, it might have a good intention in original, but then it ossifies into.
Yeah. I'm not even so sure about its good intention. Let me come back to your question there, sir, in a second. Did you have a comment?
Okay.
Yeah,
I have a question.
Further go into this, but I think you look at the philosophers of Enlightenment and you see who are their patrons. They're petty princes, merchants, those are some of the people.
Yeah.
So there are dubious intentions, I think, also to undermine the power of the church.
Please go ahead.
I was wondering, you talked about this notion of hospitality. Or friendship, and that seems to me to be tied up in sharing goods, your meals, or resources to do whatever activities you're doing, and B, sharing practices, like what is an all-you-can-eat buffet, or hunting muskrats, or fishing. And I wondered if there's also a sharing of ideas that comes with at least the hospitality that you've experienced through the exchange, whether you guys talk about the issues that we're talking about here at all. I mean, I know you said you have lectures or discussions before you guys go north, but...
Yeah, but really those ideas in a lot of ways, like that actual sharing of kind of ideas and values, it's really hard to do before you're there. Do you know what I mean? Like so much of it is just kind of you encounter, right? Do you know what I mean? And much of that, for me, is not to be all... whatever, but like the practice of it, right? Is that you can do 2 years of lectures and talking about it in discussion groups, right? But there's so much more important when you get close to it, right? That those ideas, when you encounter them actually just kind of physically or viscerally, that they begin to have some kind of impact, right? To talk about, in small things, right? Like in funny places, there's all those crazy and stupid ideas about Indians as like original like ecologists or something, you know? And so there's all this kind of romantic stuff that's thrown on natives, right? And the kids kind of bring with them, many of us bring with us. And so when the first time you go up there and you go hunting and then you have a garbage fire afterwards, take all the burning, just burn it, right? Like, well, what's that, right? I mean, just a place like that where people go, well, I thought they're supposed to live on the land. Why are they burning 25 bags of plastic garbage? That part there, when you go, okay, let's talk about that. Those are the kind of, those kind of like intersection where you go, okay, what the hell's going on? Like, you know what I mean? Those parts to talk about actual ideas, right? And not just kind of quasi-romanticized ideas, but actual ideas about how do you live like that? What's a good life look like, right? Why, or for example, this one cute kid from Good Hope, he went to freaking Church's Chicken. He's got Church's Chicken here. And he bought like $25 worth of the nastiest fried chicken ever, right? And he was walking back to my place, and some dude who I don't really like all that much, but he's been on the street forever, and he's a meth kind of dealer dude, he's a homeless guy. And he just said, you got a quarter? And the dude just went, ugh, and just handed him all his food. Like, he just had no, like, so the idea that somehow we would have people that go hungry or homeless, like, doesn't actually compute in a lot of ways. I mean, people just don't go homeless up there because if they're homeless, they're dead. Because it's just too cold. But, I mean, just even, like, looking at that piece of their attitude. So actually, when you take kids out from Good Hope around Vancouver, there's a lot of homeless people around, a lot of people asking for money. You got to actually kind of stay on them because they'll unload all their money on the first person who asks for money. But they just go, oh. And not because they're naive or, like, you know, or simplistic or whatever, right? Just because it's just an actual, it's almost like an instinctual act, right? It's like, oh yeah, sure, right, you know, great. I'm like, no, okay. I was like, don't give them fucking, you know, $75. Hold on a sec, you know what I mean? So that point there, those are the points that, yeah, you can have those intellectual discussions about, you know, your values and stuff and about the pipeline or whatever, all that stuff we can kind of do. But to me, it's those small points that I'm sure you've encountered many times with people, right? Do you know what I'm saying? Then they actually make sense. Yeah, man, please.
So I think that some of what that maybe some people are being confused, I'm being confused myself because, you know, always we thought of Canada as like, oh, you know, this is where we're going to flee when Bush wins again. You know, like, and so it's always been like that. It's always been like an image of Canada being tolerant and wild and ecological and, you know, a forward and all this stuff. But then there's also the backside of it, which is like the you know, like, They have to deal in some way with the natives, so I think maybe that Canada is more tolerant or whatever as compared to the United States that's been like basically just breaking treaties and genocidally just moving through the land. So maybe Canada didn't do that, but they.
Well, Canada certainly did that, and still doing it.
Right, but if it's not like as overt, then they think, oh yeah, Canada is a very beautiful place,
yeah,
that everybody lives happily and they have this multicultural, like that's how they, you know, put the image in the world.
Yeah, for sure. And please take care. Yeah, and it's, I mean, I don't know. I mean, that is true, and that's a great marketing scheme. And I would argue something like that part about tolerance and multiculturalism being enshrined in the Constitution. It's true, and I would argue that by quasi definition, then they're enshrining the fact that Native people have been decimated by genocide.
Right.
That's part of what's being enshrined,
exactly.
Right? Is that's being stuck, and I can't. I'll throw out one little tiny thing. I this idea of Canada is kind of. I mean, sure, there's lots of kind of nice things. I mean, socialized medicine is kind of cool or whatever, right? And there's like, there's certainly a qualitative difference between Canadian culture and American culture, writ large. But to say, for example, one of the things I noticed very primarily in Good Hope is that you had the experience of the residential schools here. So that's a huge part of Canadian culture, right? Is that so? Starting about the late 1920s or 1930s, Canadian government usually, in concert with various religious orders, often Jesuits or Catholics, would go into Native communities. This is official Canadian policy. They would take kids, official Canadian policy, deep into the 1960s, take kids away from their family at the age of 3 or 4, put them in a boarding school, and then keep them there until age 17. And the official policy, written right in and enshrined in the Indian Act, right up until the 1960s, was to kill the Indian within. So kids were punished severely if they spoke Native language, if they attempted to do anything around Native spirituality, if they dressed in any kind of traditional ways. And the idea was that not just necessarily to eviscerate all Indians per se, but to wipe out the Indian within people. so that people would speak English and act English and act Euro. And so there's all those kind of consequences. There's been a huge part about redress and about people coming back and all kind of stuff, and the Canadian government has officially apologized and all that, you know, all that kind of stuff. They're trying to make it right in some way. You go to Good Hope, and there's this really interesting thing that happens, is that I never thought about before, is that for like generations and generations, nobody in Good Hope has parented. So people have, you know, so when we take care of kids, you know, we're building on the experiences of our parents and our grandparents and the people around us and our aunts and our uncles and all that kind of stuff all around us. But in Good Hope, there's literally no experience. There's no kind of cultural, like, residue to rely on. So like my buddy Lawrence, who was on there, and he's got a kid who's 17, he's running around trying to be a thug, and he says that literally he doesn't know what to do. And he doesn't mean like in the way I would say, like, I don't know what to do. Mm. He actually doesn't know what to do. There's no one to turn to, no one to ask to, no experience, no kind of, there's no culture of parenting. If you can imagine raising kids at something maybe at like the centerpiece of our, you know, the center of any culture, right? You take that away, and you take that away for generations and generations. Irregardless of what happened in those schools or the language that got lost and all that stuff, you take away an entire culture's capacity to pass on traditions, to pass on ideas, and you wipe out this incredibly deep kind of like confidence. This confidence about you know how to behave, you know how to treat kids, you know how we move forward. And so that to me was incredibly, you know, well, sad and interesting and just powerful in all those kinds of ways, right? Is that if you wanted to like fuck a culture up, you know, taking the kids away, and then all the kind of repercussive things that happen when kids are in residential schools for all that time, and when they're, you know, every time you speak your language, you're beaten badly, or you're sexually abused, all that, there's all those, you know, psychological repercussions for the people post facto, but just the actual act of taking away parenting is incredibly powerful. Yes, please.
A question about what you were originally asking when you first started about your argument. You're saying mm-hmm. that this is the argument that you're testing out. And I was just sort of trying to figure out what it was actually that you were trying to figure out. It seemed like you were saying that, you know, decolonization is good and a worthwhile activity, and that hospitality as sort of a radical act is good in and of itself. But is your question whether or not that is furthering colonization, or
yeah, I mean,
if people aren't really work against decolonization, you know, and you live in, you know, the core metropole or whatever. I mean, I'm kind of say this half jokingly, but they say we should just kind of support all the wacko groups out there. So it's so fragmented in these countries that the global south will emerge stronger.
You want to say more to Christian, right? What you're saying?
Not that thing, though. You know, Christian fundamentalists, whatever. You know.
So you're suggesting a policy just destabilizing the global north and total? I'm not arguing with
that. No, I'm not.
Sure. Yeah, Ron Paul gets my money. yes, sir, did you have a comment?
Well, I was going to say earlier, just sort of addressing the gentleman who just left, like his question, he was asking, you know, why is it necessarily that, you know, policy or multicultural policy, you know, is not good or works against multiculturalism? And just saying that I was going to say, you know, addressing him, but I guess I'll address everyone, that, you know, multicultural policy seems to still assume the primacy of the dominant culture that creates it. And it can't really embrace, like you were saying, with hospitality and friendship and personal relationships, you know, it can't really embrace another culture. It can't really share space with another culture. It can only dictate. And I was also going to ask just a personal question to you. Like, if you consider just the idea that, you know, even when you're up north and you're sharing space with people who live there, and, you know, in a sense, I'm assuming you live their life while you're there, or live much of what their life is like. If you think about the simple fact that you can go back, like you were discussing, you know, the difficulties they have leaving, or how difficult it would be to leave for Good Hope. Like the fact that you can go back, you know, if it got too hard, you know, you can always go back.
Yeah, and just the limitedness, right? I'm only there for 2 weeks every year. You know what I mean? Like, it's not very much. People do leave there quite a bit. Like, a lot of people take off the flights, and there's lots of people who are there, you know, because they're so gangster about it. They think nothing about driving 17 hours direct to what, you know, to Yellowknife through like a bush road, you know, with no markers in the pitch black, right? I mean, they don't think anything of it. It would terrify me, right? So people do get out. But of course, I mean, that's all. I mean, the maybe the dominant characteristic of the Southern Canadian and, you know, North American culture, urban culture, is mobility, right? Change jobs, change houses, change lives, change cities, you know. And so of course, there's tons of that, right? That's live their life? Yeah, sort of. I mean, I don't smoke. So, you know, smoking and drinking coffee is a big deal of it, sitting around. I'm not a big fan of watching TV, but sitting around smoking, watching TV is a huge thing there. So, yeah, we live their life. We sit around and hang out a lot, you know. But do I understand any of it? Well, only at the most facile level, really, right? Do I live their life? Yeah, but they're big friends and they're having, you know. And there's also other kinds, you know, there's all kinds of other parts of that that are facile. You know, I mean, frankly speaking, right? And so that's part of the question too. So I guess to come back to your question, the original question, the very personal question for me is that a good project? Like, should we keep doing it? You know, or is it just too fucked up? And that part's in play for me. And then the other part is, how could, if it's true that they're okay, how could you make that, how do you make that encounter honest? You know, how do you make that valuable? And then the larger theoretical question or personal thing for me is, given that you can't, that natives and non-natives are gonna have to share space. Right, we're going to encounter each other. That's just like, genocide happened, colonialism happened. I'm here, they're here. We're not going anywhere. Now what?
Would it make more sense to do it more locally? Like, you know, is it that the contrast is so great between the communities that you're creating, what you're talking about is the question of whether you're creating a worse situation because now they're, you know, almost seeing what they're missing or whatever it is that you're sort of getting at.
Yeah,
like,
it's a good
if
point.
You did something
maybe
100 kilometers away instead of 1,700 kilometers away. Something like that.
It's a good call, but then it's a lot less exciting. Then it's a tougher sell to teenagers.
Sure. Maybe, I don't know. When I was 17, I'd be like, hell yeah, I'll go 100 miles.
I mean, that might be part of the try, is to try to concretize that in some way, you know? But then what, so...
But how are you, you know, why are you getting decided, and why are you getting decided that it's not okay? And
yeah, no, I mean, all, I mean, I think that's a good point, right? But then there's also friendships that we've started. So when we actually had a break of 2 years of funding, we just couldn't find the funding, right? It just wasn't. It was fine because they can do like, because it's so expensive to go north, they can do like 5 exchanges from east west, right? From like Manitoba to Quebec or whatever. So I understand their funding decisions, right? They can do all, many more kids can be part of an exchange, an east west French English exchange. But no matter how much I talked to them on the phone, they thought that I just wasn't going to get the money. So the woman I deal with is great, and there's an old friend, and we talked to her. She just had this idea that we didn't want to come up there. And I was saying we couldn't get the money, but actually I was full of shit, that actually I just didn't want to come.
No.
And I could only really get convince her until I got up there again, and we could do it face by face. Because she just thought I was being polite and going, you know, we didn't get the grant. You know what I mean?
Okay.
So finally when I got up there, I was like, okay, yeah, you know, really, honestly, like, we want to keep doing this. I couldn't get, you know, they said no to us. I don't know any other way to come up with that money.
Big sales just not cutting it.
I think there's all kinds of ways to think about it, but to me, what I'm trying to do, I guess, in the question, you said already, but it's just to theoretically think about that, right? How is it? And now I've kind of started this thing, now what do I do with it, right? How does that, but even a larger sense, right? It's not just Native, non-Native people, but about thinking about intercultural encounters in general, right? Is how can you do that, like, without screwing it up? You know, and maybe that's just more of a rhetorical question that privileged people and white people in particular just have to carry with them, and that's just the way it is. That, you know, if you're going to think about it honestly, you're going to wander around, but not to get paralyzed with white guilt or, you know, privileged guilt, but to try to address it honestly, right? You got to stay with it. I guess that's the question I'm asking. Yes, sir, please.
Well, I just have the simplest, most reductionist question ever. So you're proposing...
Maybe not ever, but go ahead.
You're
bring
proposing
it on.
Hospitality as a tactic.
Yes.
Essentially. So can you lay out sort of, you know, if you were to lay out sort of, you know, what are your touchstones for that tactic?
Yeah.
And just sort of to wrap this up, sort of, we talked about the hospitality as
eating food.
What?
Eating together.
Okay.
That's it. I mean, that's what it gets right down to.
Some total.
If you want reductions, is
okay.
Honestly, is share food.
Okay.
Find, cook, and eat food together.
Okay.
and if you're a good anarchist, clean up after yourself.
That's actually four things.
That's true. That's reduction.
Find, cook,
yeah,
prepare,
eat. Yeah, but all of that. And if it's hunting, or if it's going shopping,
okay.
If it's going out to, you know, to fast food, if it's whatever it is, but find, you know, cook, eat, and clean up food together. And think about that as a centerpiece of how you begin to get to know people.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that was my suggestion. I work at the Albany Free School, and so, you know, that's my suggestion for open house, actually, is that, you know, because it's an inner city neighborhood in Albany, and, you know, and having more diversity in our school, I think is, in serving the community, that particular community, I think is pretty important. And I think that's what I was suggesting. I think that's like, you know, sharing food. I mean, thing is, you know, I mean, the Hare Krishnas do that too. I mean, if they have an agenda, it's, you know, I mean, it's
not completely value-laden-less. Yeah.
Yeah,
that's what works for me, though.
Yeah.
Eat a lot together. I think we're out of time. Let's call it. If any of you were, if anybody would wants to look at a book, I bought two different kinds of books. One with a great essay by Gustav and Madhu in it. And right there, and then all $20. If anybody wants to cough up money, it'd be great. No fears. Thank you so much for your patience. I'm glad you came. Thanks a lot.